Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject. Welcome back to another fascinating episode of Inside Medical Malpractice. Today, I feel so lucky to have someone on the podcast that I've known for a long time, Toronto medical malpractice lawyer, Alex Mladenovich. Our relationship goes back about 15 years. It's been mostly professional, he the lawyer, me the nursing expert. We've worked together on several medical malpractice cases, and once I was a testifying expert in an obstetrical malpractice trial that he ran. But we've also had the very good fortune to get together socially once in a while over the years. Some dinners where we talked and laughed and ate and drank for hours. He's fun and he's funny as hell. So we bump into each other at conferences where either he or I were presenting. Sometimes it was both of us. And we'd always find time during the day or the evening to catch up. The last time we saw him in person was in January 2019 on a gorgeous beach in the Bahamas, where we were both attending a conference on obstetrics in the law. In my mind, in my memory, he was wearing a tiny little Speedo and looking buff, but that memory could be a little bit blurred with time, and I'm sure he'll tell us if that's true. Is it true?
I don't think I was wearing a Speedo, no. I'm going to say no, I was not.
And then in July of that very same year, I got word from a mutual acquaintance that Alex had contracted cancer, which just seemed to me somehow unbelievable. But as we all know, life is messy and life is unpredictable. So I reached out to him only to learn that it was true. He did have cancer. He had bowel cancer and he was undergoing treatment. I know that this has been a long and difficult journey for Alex and no doubt his family. And we're going to talk about that in part today, but not just that. This is the story of a medical malpractice lawyer who found a way to enter and trust eventually a healthcare system that he's often sued. We're going to talk about the mental and physical challenges of facing, treating, and overcoming a life-threatening illness, the ways in which this has changed his life and his practice of law, and how he found the seemingly impossible journey back to some semblance of normal life. And then, with a happy ending, we're going to discuss some of his recent accomplishments and notable trials as he's now back to running a successful practice. Before we start talking to Alex, I'd like to share with everyone a little bit about his many professional accomplishments. He's a partner in the personal injury group at Thomson Rogers with a focus on health law, medical malpractice, and personal injury. He was named one of the leading malpractice lawyers in Canada by Law Day. He has the honor of having been selected by his peers to be published in the Canadian Legal Expert Directory as a leading practitioner. He's been named one of the best lawyers in Canada in health law, malpractice, and personal injury. He's authored numerous articles and spoken at many, many conferences on the importance of litigation, process, and ensuring safety in medical care. He's a member of the Ontario Trialers Association, the Advocate Society, the Medical Legal Society, the Canadian Bar Association, a member of the American Association for Justice, a member of FAIR, which is the Fair Association of Victims for Accident Insurance Reform. Prior to joining Thomson Rogers, Alex worked in the U.S. and Canada on behalf of physicians and medical negligence matters, which has offered him a keen understanding of both sides of the personal injury and medical malpractice cases. Now, I know that there's a lot more that I could tell you about this guy, but you get the idea. He's amazing, and he's talented, and he's accomplished. So let's welcome him and then dive into some questions. So welcome, Alex. I'm so happy you're here today.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to see you.
It's been a long time. I know. 2.5 years at least since I saw you in your Speedo.
Yeah, not a Speedo. You can check with my wife. Not a Speedo. She wouldn't let me wear a Speedo.
No, I'm just kidding. My mind must just be playing tricks on me.
I know. Not going to go there.
Sorry, what did you say?
Going to go there. Wherever your mind goes, that's your business.
So as we opened with, a couple of years ago, you had some serious and unexpected health issues. And I have often thought, I mean, like being a doctor or a nurse going into the healthcare system, I think even more so for a malpractice lawyer entering the hospital healthcare system, is not only fascinating to me, I think it is to all of our listeners. I don't know if you've heard it, but we have another episode on Inside Medical Malpractice with Maya Tomjanovic, and it's titled A Medical Malpractice Lawyer Has a Baby. And it is by far one of the most downloaded episodes on the podcast. So we're all kind of fascinated about this. And to me personally, you know, knowing you and knowing the work that you've done, I can only imagine that you approached this whole thing with not only all of the complicated feelings that come as being a patient, but the complicated feelings of knowing what you know as a medical malpractice lawyer. And so tell us your story. I'm just going to give you the mic. Tell us your journey through the healthcare system, the weeks before and after. And I think you had a bit of a bumpy road. So as much as you're willing to share with us, please tell us your story.
Yeah. So it, in terms of the approach that I took to being a patient, I think my doctors and the people who were welcoming me at the hospital probably hadn't seen a lot of people come in the door like me, armed with stats and studies and literature and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it was an eye-opening experience. In June of 2019, I got diagnosed with colon cancer, which was complete shock. You know, after the diagnosis, I was told I'd need a brief course of treatment and then some surgery, and then some more treatment with chemo after that. And I was told that it was going to be a relatively straightforward 4-hour operation with a 5-day recovery, that I'd be back and, you know, at my usual pace within a few weeks. Which was obviously great. Unfortunately, it didn't work out like that. I mean, going into the surgery, which was in October of 2019, I was super fit. I actually trained for it. I had a few weeks to prepare for the surgery. So I was eating very healthily, exercising, doing all the things to prepare myself mentally and physically for the surgery. And the surgery went really well. They were able to get all of the cancer. Thankfully, it hadn't spread to my lymph nodes. They got very clear margins of resection. So from that standpoint, it was an entire success, which was great. But the aftermath of the surgery was, as you said, a rocky road. It was, I mean, I can't really recall the first few days after the surgery, the initial surgery. It was, it was sort of a roller coaster. Thankfully, I had my wife there, who is, you know, also a lawyer and a good advocate. She advocated for me. But, you know, they sent me home after about a week. I wanted to go home, but I didn't realize how sick I still was when I left the hospital. I had my surgery on a Monday, and they sent me home on a Friday morning. And I kind of knew right away when I got home that I wasn't doing well. I took myself back to the emergency that night. I had developed a bit of a wound infection, post-surgical infection. They were monitoring and watching that. And it started to look a little funky and wasn't doing what I thought it should do. So I went back to the emergency department, and they sort of took a look at me and said, "Nah, you're fine." And I was seen by one of the residents that I knew, who had been following me along that week, and we were getting along very well. Everybody knew what I did professionally, so everybody was super, super nice to me. I mean, I don't think most people have that kind of relationship with their doctors, where they kind of go into it knowing that I'm sophisticated in a way that some of their patients might not be. So he spoke to me, you know, very candidly and said, "I don't think it's a problem. You know, go home. I think you should feel better." I went home, did not feel better, brought myself back to the emergency department the next night, and said, "Look, you need to do a CT scan." And sure enough, they did a CT scan and found that there was a leak in my bowel, which needed emergency surgery. And so then the process really kind of devolved where it was a complication that was quoted to me about 2 to 3%. And suddenly there we are, sort of the worst case scenario post-operatively, and emergency surgery to repair that and clean out the mess that caused. Unfortunately, I wish I could say that was the end of it, but that sort of started a spiral of complications that kept me in hospital for another 3 weeks after that. It sent me home 45 pounds lighter than I was when I came in, very much weaker, still with a very large surgical incision, which again had become infected. And then a whole host of just sort of one disaster after another, resulting in a bit of a delay in terms of when I could get back onto my chemo regimen. But they were able to get me back on that in time, finished my course of chemo, and I've had two surgeries since then, abdominal hernia situations. And I finally got that resolved a year later, all in the middle of COVID. So it's been a bit of a journey, good, bad, and ugly. Fortunately for me, the outcome has been very positive in terms of the cancer, but it definitely was an eye-opening experience, flowing from the complications more so than the disease itself. And so, that's still something that I think about from time to time. It was a very difficult period of time for me and for my wife and my family, but happy to have gotten through it. And it certainly has sort of changed my perspective in terms of our healthcare system, what patients undergo, and what challenges doctors have as well. So, yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about, first of all, I'm sorry about the rough road that was. I know I had a couple of emails from you during that time, and I could just tell you were struggling and you were losing faith and confidence in the system. And it was hard for you to believe that you'd ever be well. What, when you say it changed your view of the healthcare system, and talk to us a little bit about that.
I guess even though I do the work that I obviously been doing this for 20 plus years now, and I see the worst case scenarios, I think there's always this tendency, at least from my perspective, to think, well, it's not going to happen to me. And the system is going to, essentially work. When you see breakdowns in the system and you see certain doctors that clearly care, others that just don't care, or don't care to the extent that they could, it changed my perspective in the sense that I fundamentally believed in our healthcare system going into this. And I think I have a little less faith in our healthcare system now, both systemically and, on a one-to-one basis. I had some remarkable doctors, people who were caring, took the time, stayed with me, came and saw me every day. I had other doctors who were not that caring, I'm not going to say dismissed my concerns, but certainly I felt like they weren't being respected or honored, and I didn't feel like I was getting the attention that I want. I'm not going to name names, obviously, but fairly prominent physicians in their field, and so yeah, it was definitely eye opening. Many patients or clients who come to me, they have a story to tell, and they talk about lack of respect or conversations that they've had, or instances where doctors have been dismissive or rude, or just disregarding their concerns. And I always thought, okay, well, that's a bit of a biased perspective. They're probably trying to do their best. But when you see it happening to you, even when you're advocating for yourself, it really brings home the message that some people in our system are just not as considerate, as thoughtful, as professional, as courteous as they should be. And that has an impact. I don't know that my surgeon did anything wrong medically, but it was the approach and the conversations or the lack of compassion or sympathy that I think really struck me at a time when I needed that confidence, it wasn't there from one particular doctor, and that affected me, and it actually stayed with me for months and months afterwards, even after I was well physically. That really bothered me a lot, and I understand now why some of my clients are fixated on that, on the way they were treated or talked to or talked down to, because that does happen. It does happen. And if it happens to someone who works in the medical malpractice field, someone who is sophisticated enough to understand the terminology, understand the medicine to some degree, then I can only wonder what's happening to people who don't have that level of awareness or training.
Yeah, I think truly, truly challenges exist if you don't have someone like you or me or are you or me or have a really strong advocate with you. Do you have, or can you recall an example? I'd like to hear if there was a healthcare hero in there. Like, was there a moment where someone just saved the day for you when you really need it?
I had a single nurse who cared for me both before my first surgery and my second surgery, who was literally a lifesaver. She mm-hmm. came on every day, and she kept me going when it was really, really difficult after those surgeries. She was fantastic. I owe her a huge debt. One of my surgeons also was tremendous. He was just, literally the kind of doctor that anyone would want. He explained things going into it. He was a sympathetic ear. When the biopsy results came back from the pathology after the surgery with clear margins and no lymph node involvement, he ran to my room and he ran and celebrated with me. So that meant a lot. I'm getting a little emotional just thinking about that moment, but that meant a lot.
I'm getting emotional thinking about it. Like, what a gift for someone to give you to share in the excitement of your good health and your good fortune.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of nurses who listen to the podcast. What did that nurse do that got you through those tough days? Was it her demeanor, her actions, her words, her humor?
Everything. I mean, she treated me like a human being. When she came around, as they do to monitor, see how you're doing and take your vitals and give you the meds. Some nurses will take the time to talk to you. Others don't. I didn't get bad treatment from any of the nurses that saw me, but some of them were exceptional, and the exceptional ones were exceptional because they cared, and they obviously cared. When you're that vulnerable, when you're at your absolute lowest point in your life, you have friends and family come visit you, but there are a lot of lonely hours in the middle of the night where you're not sleeping. Hospitals are a difficult place to sleep when you're being monitored and being given meds every 3 or 4 hours.
They're terrible.
So in a moment where you're supposed to be sleeping and getting as much rest because your body needs it, I was absolutely sleep deprived in a hospital. The food isn't very good. That's, a really, really sad state of affairs in our healthcare industry. When we have food that is as bad as the food that I was getting, it's not healthful food. It's not good for you. It's not conducive to recovery, particularly from, a significant trauma or a surgery. But in those moments in the middle of the night where you're scared or you're tired and you're alone, that nurse is the only connection you have to the outside world other than your phone, and no one's awake at that time. So this particular nurse was remarkable in the way that she approached my recovery. When I was down, she got me up. She encouraged me I'm pretty crazy about exercise and staying fit. So I tried to move around as much as possible. And when she'd see me moving around as I did, around that ward over and over and over again, she would always give a little cheer from the nursing desk. There he goes again. How many laps is that? That kind of thing. And that just shows a level of, compassion and care that it makes such a huge difference when you are weak and vulnerable and scared.
That's so fascinating and so really good to hear, because so much of healthcare, I mean, there's the actual healthcare and the delivery and the procedures and the dressing changes and the drugs and the IVs and every other thing that goes on. Yeah. But so much of it is really about the compassionate care and the kindness and the friendship and the real caring. And they're all caring. So I'm glad that was such a, those parts of it were positive for you. You mentioned a little bit about your family, and you and I have talked a lot about your beautiful wife and your mama in particular. How are they doing?
They're doing well. I mean, it's been a rough ride for, I think, everybody in Canada and around the world with COVID you know, being sick, you know, during the pandemic and going into hospitals when you're vulnerable, and you might not be at your best in terms of your immunity. That's a challenge. And so you really do rely on the people around you a lot. Your world gets a lot smaller, when you're sick. And then when the world itself gets a lot smaller because of a pandemic, that just sort of amplifies those familial relationships. So I leaned heavily on my wife, and I mean heavily on her. And to her credit, she just didn't stop. She kept me going. She kept me as positive as she could. And that was challenging at the best of times. But it was so important to have that connection. I don't know what I would have done if I was sick alone. If I was, you know, if I didn't have her, I really don't know how I would have managed so many of those situations. Times when I couldn't advocate for myself because I was either too sick or too scared to advocate for myself. And believe it or not, that happened too. As tenacious as I am in my legal practice, and as aggressive as I can be sometimes in court, it's amazing how when it's personalized, sometimes you're afraid to ask certain questions, or sometimes you get an answer from a doctor and you don't follow up, and you don't even give your side of the story as well. And sometimes she'd just be there to say, well, you know, don't you want to also say this? This is also important, you know. So she would speak up for me when I was either forgetful or afraid or just not able to, which is remarkable as well.
That's a good wife right there. It's a good partner.
She is.
And thank you. Really thank you, Alex, for just sharing that human side of you with everyone. Because I think that's important for us all to know that you can be the toughest bastard on the planet. But when it hits home, it's real. And we're all afraid. We're all afraid at the end of the day, regardless of what we know and who we are. It's a scary thing to go through. So thank you for sharing that with us.
You're welcome. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, for a long time, I didn't want to talk about it with a lot of people. I mean, I never made a secret of it, but after the complications happened, I did kind of shut down to a lot of people, and it took a little time for me to process that before I could talk about it in a way that made sense. And it's still an ongoing thing, right? Like it's not something that I've overcome by any means. It's still a part of me, but I think it's a healthy part of me. I think it's important to acknowledge that. I'd never had any health issues before this. I was, you know, I thought one of the healthiest people I knew, physically, emotionally, all of that. I hadn't struggled with any major problems until this sort of smacked me in the face. And then it was, all right, well, let's see what you're made of. And I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for the complications. Even going into my surgery, I thought, I'm going to breeze through this. If anyone's going to push through this, it's going to be me. There's going to be no problems. And so I was kind of gobsmacked. And it bruised my ego when I, you know, why am I one of the 3% who has this complication? How is that possible? I'm healthy. I'm strong. I'm relatively young. So like, why am I not able to get out of this bed?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's humbling. It's mind expanding. I think it's made me certainly more compassionate to people who through no fault of their own have suffered through their health or through other, you know, injuries or accidents. It's amazing what human beings are able to take for granted, and when it's taken away, how you see the world in a way that is fundamentally different from the way you see it. There's sort of a before and after picture for me in terms of my life. And I as hard as the after has been, I like the person who has emerged from the after. I like that person better than the person I was before, believe it or not.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. What is the most valuable thing you learned from this experience, and what's better about your after than you had before? I know you mentioned you're more compassionate, more understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't take things for granted. I took my health for granted. I took my physical vitality for granted. I took my life for granted in many ways. And when you're faced with, you know, potentially life-threatening illness and then complications that are more life-threatening than the illness itself, in that moment, you do a lot of soul searching. I mean, I said goodbye to my wife before the second surgery, not knowing if we didn't know if I was going to make it. Cause the, you know, having a leak in your bowel is a very significant problem. You get septic very, very quickly, go into septic shock. And given that I was still recovering from, you know, a significant surgery to begin with, and I was not well, you know, how is your body going to manage to fight it off? And so in those moments where you think, wow, like this could be over, I might not wake up from this. So either you change, either that changes you or there's something wrong with you. If that doesn't change you, then you should reevaluate. But that certainly did change me. It certainly changed my perspective on everything, on every aspect of my life.
I'm getting very emotional listening to that. I mean, I knew you were going through some tough stuff, but I didn't have any understanding that it was that tough. So
it was pretty dark, but we don't have to get dark. It doesn't have to get dark. It was an awakening in a way.
Yeah.
It was definitely an awakening, and a pivotal point in my life, I think. Ironic that I went into it as a medical malpractice lawyer and came out of it as a patient, and seeing, yeah, you know, being a patient as being something that's incredibly challenging and often misunderstood. I think by doctors as well. I think nurses have a better understanding of it because I think they see us as patients more. They deal with us as patients more. That some doctors get it, some doctors don't get it, which is not to say that they're bad people. I think that the focus is very clinical sometimes as opposed to human.
Yes, and you're absolutely right on that. I've read more than one story about the doctor who becomes a patient and, you know, going through whatever treatment, surgery, cancer, all kinds of things, or, you know, develops a chronic illness. And it changes their approach to doctoring too. They just said, I never understood this aspect of it. I just dealt with the illness, yeah, and the disease and the diagnosis and the treatment, and boom. And you also have some, don't you have some like medic background? Not like, you're not just a medical malpractice lawyer. Aren't you also like a medic of some sort?
I'm not just a pretty face.
I never thought so.
I was a medic in the army for a couple of years. Right. So I do have some, you know, some very basic medical training that I did back in the 90s. I volunteered during high school. I volunteered at hospitals. So I very much immersed myself, you know, before starting as a medical malpractice lawyer and in medicine. I, you know, had a biochemistry undergrad at McMaster, and we worked in the health sciences building. So we were sort of shoulder to shoulder with the doctors and the scientists in that building. And so I had a very keen understanding of what I thought medicine was. You know, that changed when I became a medical malpractice lawyer. But the whole thing kind of got blown up when I became a patient. I mean, it's a completely different ballgame. It's an interesting thing, because even though, you know, some of the doctors who I have, you know, my biggest gripes about were fantastic in terms of what they did for me. I mean, they saved my life, sometimes more than once. So I can't ever not be grateful. I'm so grateful to them for what they did. But at the same time that you're saving my life, you're telling me, well, you know, you got to toughen up and suck it up. And you're, you know, I see patients that are way, way worse than you. That's kind of not the message that I want to hear when I'm in your office, in your clinic, you know, 2 weeks after surgery, when I've lost 40 pounds and I'm barely able to move and I need someone to help me at home. You know, suck it up. I've seen worse. You're not going to die. Those kinds of things.
Yeah,
it's good locker room talk, but
yeah,
no, it's not what you always want to hear from your doctor.
No, and it's not helpful, and it's not healing, is it? That will often cause more upset. It's not motivating, is it? It's not motivating in any sense.
Right. I mean, it kind of felt like you should not be complaining, or you should be doing more. There's something more that you should be doing, or not worrying so much. Why are you in here? And you know, one of the problems with being a medical malpractice lawyer and knowing, you know, a little bit about the system and knowing a little bit about medicine is you start becoming very, very paranoid very quickly about every symptom that you have, whether it's related to your surgery or your, you know, the cancer or what is it. And you start getting very, very vigilant and, you know, writing letters or emails or calling your doctor. Sometimes more than you might necessarily want to, but if it's a concern, you know, calling or asking for an appointment seems like a reasonable thing to do. And I guess what was disappointing about my encounters with some doctors, not all, was that some of them would just not care. Yeah. They wouldn't take the time to respond, whereas others would respond almost immediately. And those are the people that, you know, I think are, you know, go above and beyond. Which is important for all of us, particularly when you're really, really sick, you know.
So there are a lot of doctors who listen into this podcast. What do you wish that guy who said to you, you got to suck it up, you know? What did you need to hear in that moment when you're sitting there feeling terrible and 40 pounds down and can't get out of bed? What did you need to hear from him?
I think what I wanted to hear from him at that point was, you've done the worst part of it. Like you made it through, man. Like we got the cancer. The complication that you had was terrible. And you're still here and you're over the hump. Now it's going to take some time. And here's realistically what this is going to take. I don't feel like I ever got a real sense of how difficult the road was going to be, because I think the tendency is to downplay what's happened. Exposure to liability, but because they do see the worst case scenarios, and they do see the people who are worse than me. Of course they do, and so I think the tendency is to lump me into a certain category of patient, as opposed to dealing with the human being that you're seeing in front of you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would talk to me about sample size. Well, if you saw the sample size that I saw patients, then you wouldn't be worried. That's clinical. I guess it's reassuring on some level to him. But again, when we're talking about sample sizes, we're talking about, you know, medical studies, and I'm not in a medical study. I'm in your office having, I mean, you've seen my insides now twice, you know, we're past that. So just talk to me like you talk to your family member or friend. And I guess what I want doctors to know, and this is probably really challenging, but I think there needs to be an orthogonal change in terms of the way doctors and healthcare providers treat their patients. And that has to start with treating them with a sense of dignity, compassion, and as if they were your family. Because as close as I was to my family, I was putting my hands in the life of a total stranger.
Yes.
I was allowing him to do to me, you know, what nightmares are made of. And I wanted to know that he cared. I wanted to know that it mattered. I wanted to know that I mattered to him. And, you know, as good of a surgeon as you are, the other stuff's important too. I'm not going to say more important, but it is important.
Sure. And you'll know that from your work also, right? The studies that show if your patients like the doctor or the nurse, they're much less likely to ever even sue them, right? If they like them as a person and they feel cared for, even when things go wrong, that will sometimes avoid the lawsuit because they felt cared for.
That's right. And that's an important point. But the other part that's actually really important is I've seen studies that go the other way, that if your doctor likes you, they're more likely to be a better doctor to you. That if the doctor likes the patient, that the outcome for the patient tends to be better. And so, you know, you read these studies that say it's better to smile when you meet your doctor, because it's important to sort of enlist that doctor as a teammate, someone who wants to fight for you, because sometimes it's going to take a person who's willing to go that extra step.
Yeah.
And sometimes even the doctors that I'm complaining about now would take that extra step because I did everything I could to sort of, I wouldn't say ingratiate myself, but I wanted them to like me because I wanted them to feel invested in my outcome, which is, you know, sad, but I mean, that's just human nature, I think.
Yeah, it is kind of sad when you're at the lowest point in your life and all you probably wanted to do is just cry like a baby and complain and scream and get over, you know, and somebody take care of me. It's a tough balance to be nice and ingratiating and kind, but be truthful about what's really going on and ask and advocate for yourself. That's a very fine line to walk sometimes. But it sounds like you maybe did okay, or I hope you did.
I did. I mean, at the end of the day, I think I did as well as I could. I got the care that I needed, which was important. I did advocate for myself when I could, and I had others advocate for me when I couldn't. So, overall, it was challenging, eye-opening, certainly a window into a world that I glance at every day, but never really saw until it happened to me. And so now when a client comes to me and tells me a story of how everything unraveled after a surgery, or how miscommunications occurred between the medical team, whereas before I might raise an eyebrow and think, are they really telling me the truth here? Now I'm more inclined to believe what they're telling me, even when it sounds far-fetched. I've heard people tell me stories about doctors getting to arguments about their care. I've now seen that. I've my wife literally saw two medical teams arguing about what to do with me. They couldn't agree, and they were hashing it out right there in my room and within earshot. Right. And some of those stories where if a patient told me I might not necessarily accept now, I think I'm more likely to believe them, which is important too, because I realize now that as a medical malpractice lawyer, even though I'm not providing them care, I am in some ways an extension of the medical system, because I'm there to get them compensation and justice when the healthcare system failed them. So it's important. Just as important as it is for the doctors to listen to me and be compassionate, it's just as important for me in the aftermath to be attentive, compassionate, and listen with an open mind and an open heart, and not just be clinical, which is not just a tendency for lawyers or nurses or healthcare providers or doctors. It's all of us. And I think we all need to know that. So
I think that's a lovely and important lesson for you to have learned and for you to share with everybody. that we could probably all do better at. I mean, my case is not nearly as extreme as yours, but just as a nurse who's a mother, my kids will tell you that, you know, unless you're bleeding and dead on the floor, you better not complain about very much. You know, Steve, who's producing this show, has had more than one broken bone, or at least one. And I'm like, well, just get on your bike and ride home, you know. So he rides home. All my kids had broken bones and serious injuries. And those are like, you know, and I'm a decent person and I'm caring, compassionate. But man, I mean, it's the point that you just made is a really good one for all of us to listen and hear the other story. So A, thank you for learning it. And B, thank you for sharing it.
My pleasure.
I'd like to move on because you, you know, you've come, well, how are you doing now? Let's talk about moving through this.
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. I'm, you know, I think I'm fit as a fiddle. I'm, you know, I'm back to doing everything I wanted to do. I'm physically healthier now, I hope, than I was, before all of this happened. I definitely eat differently. I don't eat a lot of red meat or meat of any kind at all anymore. I exercise in a different way. I try to, you know, focus on the important things. I do meditate now. I try to stay in touch with, you know, what matters. When it comes to work, I'm working full time now, full throttle, and have been for some time now, for more than a year now. Work's more interesting and engaging. I think I'm a better lawyer for the experience. A better husband, hopefully, my wife would agree. Just a better human being, which is all that we should ever aspire to be, I think.
Mm-hmm. Two things that you just said, I'm interested to hear. Talk us through what you eat in a day, because I'd like to hear what your healthy diet is. I'm sure everybody would. And the second thing is, I would like to hear how this changed your lawyering, how this is like, what's different about you as a lawyer that you say you're a better lawyer?
Sure. Well, the diet tips first, because that's easy. So, yeah. You know, lots of cruciferous vegetables. So lots of broccoli, cauliflower, I tend to like Brussels sprouts. So I try to get greens pretty much with every meal. In the morning, I usually just have some oatmeal with some walnuts and blueberries or blackberries or whatever I can that's fresh, or pomegranate seeds. For lunch, you know, it's usually like a green salad of some kind, maybe a little bit of a fish with that. And then at night, maybe a little bit of pasta or rice, again, with a lot of vegetables. And if we do a little fish, with that, okay. If not, that's fine. But during the day, I'm usually munching on, walnuts and almonds and apples. In terms of exercise, I run, I play a lot of tennis. I used to be, you remember when I was buff in my Speedo. I used to carry a lot more muscle mass, sort of a bit of a meathead in the gym for a while. That's gone. I'm not trying to impress anyone with my massive biceps and pecs anymore. But in place of that, I can run a lot. I can run pretty much anywhere I want to run to now. That's great. So that's it. I mean, just basically taking care of yourself. And in terms of, you know, my approach to the law now, I think it's a gift. It really is a gift to be able to do this work. You know, I'd get up in the morning before this and I would be resentful for whatever defense lawyer had slighted me. You know, the day before, if someone was being unreasonable on a file, I would take it personally. I still have that fire, and I still get righteous when I feel like, you know, someone's doing something that I don't agree with. But it's different. It's got a different sheen to it, a different perspective, and I think that makes me more effective. You know, the other side we've already talked about, which is just the way I feel about my clients now. I think I can definitely empathize with them more than I would sympathize with them before. Now I feel like we've got sort of a more of a connection. I can understand them better. And I think that comes through when I'm talking to them.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it does. I have no doubt it does. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that time in your life before we move a little bit forward?
Let's move on. We've bored everyone to death with that. No one wants to hear, you know, my diet tips anymore.
Are you kidding? Diet tips are the hottest thing going, especially around the holiday season. Everybody wants to hear diet tips around Christmas and January. So that's really good. Yeah. I'd like for you to just take a one last second to answer two questions before we move on, because I'd like to hear what you're doing now. And I know you've been up to some big stuff in the last year. Is there anything in particular that you would like doctors and nurses to know about your experience?
Nothing in particular that strikes me, other than just let that guard down a little bit. Let that mold that you've been living in for the longest time, where it's all about studies and stats and sample size, put that away for a minute. When, you know, deal with that when you're at your conferences, right? When you're dealing with your colleagues, by all means, talk about all the stats and the studies. That's great, because that's how science is done. But when you're with a patient, when you're with a family, just be a person and put yourself in their shoes for a minute, just for a minute, and think, what would this be like? Is this patient a complainer, or is he actually really struggling? And if he's struggling, why? And what can I do about it? Or, you know, and that was a real failing. And it was what was really, really, really disappointing to me about the system was how it failed me, not so much medically, but emotionally. You know, my wife was very concerned about my emotional stability during all of this while I was in the hospital. And she begged for someone from psych or psychology to come and see me. It never happened. It never did. In the nearly month that I was there in isolation, and I was in isolation at times, you know, in the darkest moments, that lack of emotional, mental health support was shocking. It was shocking. And it wasn't as if we weren't asking for it. And so what I would say to doctors and nurses, if you've got a patient who's in hospital for a period of time, they're struggling, I think you really need to advocate for that person to get the kind of healthcare, mental health care services, as well as the physical health services that you're providing every day. And we forget that. And you're not treating my abdomen. You're not treating my colon. You're not even treating a wound. You're treating a person. And my immune system is connected to my brain. You can't cut my brain away from the situation, and my mind is working. And if my mind isn't right, then how do you expect my body to be right? If I'm stressed and worried, whether I'm going to, you know, make it to the next set of vitals, something else has to come into the picture. And we talk a good game about mental health in this country. Doctors talk about it, nurses talk about it, but we got to start putting our money where our mouth is when it comes to this stuff. And if it could affect me that much, then, you know, people who have a history of mental health problems, people who are anxious or otherwise vulnerable, I don't know how they get through it. Mm-hmm. Because I was just allowed to sort of get through it as I could.
That's a really, really good chunk of advice that you've just offered up there. And I think especially in the acute care setting, the mental health, the social work, the mental health nurses, they're limited, and you don't often, and the staff doesn't even always think to give you access to mental health. So I'm really sorry that didn't happen for you. So the next question you may have just answered, because it is, if you had unlimited, nothing but time and money and no red tape, how would you change the healthcare system that we have right now?
I think it would be a lot more patient focused than it is now. I think now it is a numbers game to some degree. And that is as a result of lack of funding for our healthcare system. No one wants to pay taxes, right? So you get the healthcare system that you get when there's a lack of funding. I think mental health issues surrounding physical health issues are underreported. They're not dealt with properly. I think we need an entirely different approach to medicine. If we had all the resources in the world, I would say treat the person as a whole person. That means top to bottom. That means my nutritional health, which is abysmal in our hospitals. Mm-hmm. It means our mental health support, which is frankly lacking in our hospitals. It means compassion. It means understanding. And it means taking the time to at least look somebody in the eye and take a moment so that they know that you're there, that you're paying attention, that you're not just off to the next, you know, call. That's what I would advocate for. But that's, some people will say that's utopian. I think we could do it. I just think we have to prioritize that.
And I think it's perfectly doable. It is. It doesn't even need a ton of money or a big budget change. It just needs an attitude shift. Yeah. That's what you just described there. It isn't a big bunch of government funding. It's just all of us looking at each other as human beings and seeing the whole person. I love how you said that from top to bottom and realizing how connected everything is, how connected your mental health is to your physical health and to your nutritional health. Like as a nurse, I worked in hospitals for 30 years and I don't think I ever ate a single meal. I would pack, if I worked a 12-hour shift, I would pack my breakfast, lunch, and supper because I'm like, there's no way I'm going to eat what's going on there. Even in the hospital cafeteria most days, I was like, No, it's just different than the patient food, but there's no.
And why is that? You've worked in hospitals. What is happening in our hospitals that they can't give us nutritious, healthy food, things that aren't packed with carbs or why can't we get fresh vegetables and fruits and things that we know are good for us?
I don't have a full answer for that. I know there's 1,000 different dietary needs that they have to deal with. And, you know, sometimes someone's only on full fluids or just clear liquids. And some people are no salt and some people are no fat and some people are no fiber. They're dealing with all kinds of different disease processes that require a lot of diets, but I don't have a good answer to that. And I think there are hospitals in the world who do it much better than ours do. I still cannot stand the look of a bowl of oatmeal and a cup of apple juice with one of those pull-off metal lids.
Apple juice. Right. I remember the apple juice and orange juice, and I'm thinking, oh, you just want to pack me full of sugar here, do you?
I know.
Give me some apple juice concentrate.
Can't do it. A cup of tea that tastes like coffee because it's made in the same old plastic cup and everything's lukewarm. But anyway, here's a call to hospitals if anybody's listening. Everybody wants better food.
I think we should get a better meal at a hospital than you do, say, in the Canadian prison system. I'm not sure we do that. I'm not sure we're getting better meals in hospitals than the prison system. I think there's an argument.
That doesn't sound like too high of a bar.
I haven't been to prison yet, but I'm pretty sure that the food in prison is better.
Well, don't go to prison, for God's sake. That's the one thing that keeps me living a pretty straight line, because I'm like, no gracias to the prison.
I'll try to stay out of the slammer.
Yeah, I do. All right, let's move forward now, because you mentioned that a year ago you were back at work full time and you're pretty much, you know, doing all the things. You told me that in maybe February or sometime last year, you ran a full medical malpractice trial.
Yep.
And I believe it was called Somerville v. Fine and Brown. Am I right on that?
Yeah.
So let's hear this, because it's an interesting case and I'd love to hear some of the details, the issues, and how it ended up all the way in trial.
Well, it ended up in trial because the defense didn't want to settle the case, notwithstanding many, many years of badgering by yours truly. So this was a really interesting and important case. My client, Andrew Somerville, was a young guy who, back in 2008, was minding his own business when he was attacked viciously by a man with a knife, stabbed multiple times, including four times in his leg, in and around his knee, and ended up actually lacerating the patellar tendon of his knee, which is the tendon that helps you extend your leg. And he went to hospital, went to the emergency department, was seen by an emergency room physician, Dr. Jeffrey Fine, who didn't take it seriously, in my respectful submission, didn't pay attention to Andrew. I think what he did was really just diminish what Andrew was telling him. Andrew wasn't able to extend his knee, wasn't able to move his knee. He was in a great deal of pain. His knee was swollen. He described his kneecap sort of pointing straight up, even though he had his knee bent at an angle. And his kneecap, he said, was pointing straight up to the ceiling, which should have tipped anybody off that your kneecap is no longer attached to the tendon. So he, you know, reluctantly took an x-ray, but didn't look really pay attention to the x-ray because the x-ray showed air inside the knee joint capsule, which is an area of your knee that is supposed to be hermetically sealed. It's not supposed to have any air in it. The air was clearly evident on the x-ray. And like I said, Andrew wasn't able to extend his leg. But he diagnosed him with, you know, a superficial injury, sewed up the wounds around his knee and sent him home without getting orthopedic surgery assessment, without getting an MRI or a CT scan of the knee to determine what was happening with the tendon. And then, you know, what happened in that situation was, you know, often what happens when things aren't done properly, it snowballs. So Andrew's mom, who came to pick him up from the hospital, was there, and there was actually a police officer who was standing guard outside Andrew's room because he'd been stabbed. And so there were some security concerns that he might be at risk. And so the police officer told his mother that Andrew had been sent for a CT scan when in fact he'd been sent for an x-ray. And Andrew was young and didn't know the difference at that time between, you know, an x-ray machine and a CT scan machine. They're actually fairly similar in that setting. And so his mom, who actually worked for a family physician who was Andrew's family doctor, left thinking that there's been a CT scan. And so she ended up calling the hospital repeatedly to follow up on the CT scan results and was told repeatedly that the report wasn't ready, not that Andrew had not had a CT scan. So by the time she figured out that no CT scan had actually been done, weeks had gone by. When they finally figured out that, the family doctor ordered a CT scan. The CT scan showed serious problems. And then an MRI was done, which showed a complete laceration of the patellar tendon. It was cut straight through. And so the original injury occurs in September. It's not until November that they make the diagnosis of the laceration. He's sent urgently to see an orthopedic surgeon. The orthopedic surgeon says, you know, you're outside of that 8-week window where your repair is going to be likely successful. So we'll try, but no promises. So he has the surgery to reconstruct his knee. Within a few months, that fails because of the fact that the tendon had retracted. And then he needed a subsequent reconstruction again, a further surgery, and he's been left with some serious disability. And Andrew's he's a working guy. He runs his own contracting business, so it's very physically demanding work. And it's been hard for him. It's been hard for him to get back to that level. And so that's what our case was about, was the care that he had received from Dr. Fine in that emergency department that morning in September of 2008. And our argument was that you didn't pay attention to the complaints. You didn't pay attention to the x-ray imaging, which showed an arthrotomy of the knee, meaning there had been a breach of the joint capsule with the knife, which is inherently a dirty object. And when you introduce a dirty object like a knife into what's supposed to be a pristine, hermetically sealed capsule, you run the risk, a serious risk of an infection, which can be life or limb threatening. And so it was incumbent upon him to get an orthopedic surgeon. And our evidence was that if an orthopedic surgeon had been consulted, they would have done an MRI, they would have gone in and repaired the tendon, and Andrew would have had a relatively good outcome, certainly much better than the one he did. Well, one would think that that would be a fairly straightforward proposition, but Dr. Fine didn't agree. He insisted that he had, in fact, asked Andrew to extend his knee, and that Andrew was able to extend his knee quite well. The trial turned around some entries that Dr. Fine made in the note in the emergency room record, which suggested that he had done an assessment of the tendons, and he wrote an entry that said tendons within normal limits. To him, that meant he had asked Andrew to extend his leg. The only problem was Dr. Fine didn't seem to understand what the tendon did, because at his examination for discovery, when I asked Dr. Fine what he had what the tendon did, he said it extends and flexes the knee. Well, the patellar tendon does not flex the knee. It merely serves to extend it. And so our experts felt that Dr. Fine didn't have a very good understanding of the function of the tendon. Therefore, how could he properly assess the tendon? In the course of the trial, he acknowledged that, yes, he had said that the tendon both extends and flexes the knee, but he knows very well that it only extends the knee. He said, though, that what he meant by it extends and flexes the knee was that it counterbalances flexion, which means it has two functions, to extend and to counterbalance flexion. So in my closing argument, I said that's like saying that the brakes on your car serve two functions. One, to slow you down when you push the brake pedal, and the other, to accelerate your car when you lift your brake, your foot off the pedal. And the judge, I thought that was kind of amusing. But you know, we were faced in that trial with you know, two very conflicting versions of what happened during an assessment, and which is what we see in medical malpractice cases almost all the time. The client says, well, the doctor didn't do this, or, you know, did do that. And the doctor says, no, I absolutely did that. And my note says I did. And so how do you reconcile those two? If Dr. Fine's note was to be believed, that tendons within normal limits meant that Andrew was able to fully extend his knee with no quadriceps lag in the tendon, and during extension, then he would have discharged his obligation to do an assessment. The question became, did he do that? And we made a fairly unusual argument, and it was very technical and radiological. We argued it was impossible for you to have actually gotten Andrew to extend his knee, because his knee was complete, his patellar tendon was completely lacerated. How did we know that? Well, we worked our way backwards. We got some very, very good radiology opinion evidence from Dr. Gordon Chung, who's a very good radiologist. We got the treating surgeon, Dr. Steven Rosenfeld, who treated Andrew's knee. He's the orthopedic surgeon that fixed his knee in initial surgery, who said, when I saw Andrew and I opened his leg to repair his tendon was completely lacerated. It wasn't like slightly injured and then torn apart like the way the defense theory was. It was completely lacerated. It was as if someone had taken a scalpel and cut the whole thing. The defense theory in this case was Andrew's patellar tendon may have been a little bit injured, but he had done something afterwards. After he was sent home, he fell or tripped or did something that must have completely disrupted this tendon. And that's why he was able to extend, and that's why it was fine to send him home. Well, our surgical experts and our radiologic expert says, no, that's impossible. The tendon was completely lacerated, and we can tell by comparing the height of the patella over various times in the X-ray from September to CT scan in October to the MRI in November. And they did what was almost like a CSI forensic kind of working backwards analysis to prove, I think, very, very distinctively and almost with certainty that Andrew's patellar tendon was lacerated completely when he was seen by Dr. Fine, which puts to a lie any notion that Andrew was able to extend his leg during that assessment. And so the judge Madam Justice Vella called that factual causation. So she worked her way backwards. She established factual causation, meaning what actually happened, what was the state of the knee at the time that Dr. Fine saw this patient, and does it jibe with what his note says? And she just found it didn't, which was really the central issue in the case. So an interesting case, and ultimately a good result for Andrew. We were able to prove our case. And obviously it was very exciting, very emotional for him and for all of us on our team, and Stephen Berman and I, and Ava Williams on Thompson Rogers. We did a very interesting trial, and it was my first virtual trial. I'd never done a virtual trial before. And so it was very, very interesting to see all the radiology imaging, very highly technical information going in through the platform that we are now on Zoom, and seeing how well it worked at trial. It was really a beautiful thing. It worked so well. I certainly had a lot of trepidation going into a virtual trial. All the trials that I'd ever done before had been obviously in person, in court, where you can see everything and you can put things up and project them if you want. I was very, very concerned that I might not be able to do that on this kind of a format. But in fact, I think it worked to our advantage in a way, because it focused the judge's attention on the imaging. And when Dr. Fine was squirming in the stand, I mean, his face is right there for all to see. There's no getting away from it. It's Zoom is very, very good, almost like a lie detector in that respect, I think.
That's a great story, a fascinating, you know, where the medical evidence apparently, obviously was so important. How is Andrew doing now? Like after those surgeries, what's he been left with?
Well, he's quite, you know, he's got quite a bit of disability in his leg. And so Andrew is now, you know, into his early 30s, still a young man. He now has a child, and he's a father, and so he's working hard. He's still trying to work as much as he can. But the biggest concern for him is over time, what's going to happen. He'll likely need a total knee replacement at some point. And so his career is certainly going to be foreshortened, I expect. But, you know, he's doing as well as he can. He's certainly gratified by the outcome of the trial, because, you know, to some large extent, it was an issue of credibility between him and Dr. Fine, who was to be believed. And that's such an important idea that we have to always keep in mind as medical malpractice lawyers, is oftentimes the tendency is to believe whatever's in a medical record. So if a doctor writes, you know, discussed risks and benefits, and your client says to you, no, nobody told me anything, the tendency is to say, well, it's in paper. It's right here. It's written contemporaneously. It has to be true. It's not always the case. Sometimes in a case like this, where you have forensic evidence that can disprove it, you can show that the doctor was not telling the truth and your client was. But in many, many cases, you don't have that opportunity. And it's got to be frustrating as hell for a patient who says, like, look, this was an important moment for me. I remember this. This doctor sees hundreds of patients in a week. I was nothing to him. And in fact, Dr. Fine didn't remember seeing him. He didn't remember the encounter, but Andrew did. So
of course he did.
So you know, it's important. Who do you believe? And how do you prove it?
Well, it sounds like you did a good job. Congratulations. Sounds like a fascinating trial.
It was an interesting trial.
How did it feel to be back in the saddle again?
Just like it always does. Your juices start flowing, and it becomes, you know, trials are unique experiences. Each one is very, very different. Each one becomes personal. And you know, you remember every one of those cases. We don't go to trial that often. I'm in trial every couple of years, every year or two, if I'm lucky or unlucky. It's so consuming. You know, when we worked on our trial together, how consuming that was and how much work it was preparing you. And you're a very good witness. You were excellent. And, you know, the night before we're going through our evidence and, oh, we got to rework it. And then, you know, you spend your whole night reworking the evidence, and then it comes in the next day and you do that, and it's exhausting, but it's rewarding. It's the best work and the worst work, because it's the only kind of work that's worth doing, really, as a medical malpractice lawyer, doing these kinds of cases, because it focuses you. But at the same time, it's so all consuming that everything else, sort of including your personal life, tends to fall away for those weeks that you're involved in the case. But
sure. I remember that time, the trial that we were in together, the trial prep.
Yeah.
And I've joked about this before being some version of the seventh circle of hell.
Yeah.
But then getting on the stand and thinking, oh, well, this is easy. But I ended up flying directly from that trial. It was a 50th birthday gift from my husband, and we were on the way to Rome. I literally flew directly from that trial to Rome. And I was just kind of so exhausted. And I was on the stand for a couple of days, I remember, 2.5 days. It was a long thing. I was so like just exhausted and run out at the end of it that I threw my stuff in a suitcase, but I left everything that was in a drawer in a drawer. So all my underwear, all my jewelry, all my socks.
No.
I ended up in Rome with
like, so you got to go shopping in Italy is what you're telling me.
I did, which was kind of fun, except I can remember going to the underwear store or the lingerie store, and there's a man in front of the counter, and everything's back there behind the counter. You have to have a conversation with the man about exactly what you need, and then he decides what you're going to get, and he goes back and gets it. But it was an experience. But I at the end of that too thought, well, I mean, that was really tough and really hard, but I'm so glad I did it. You learn a lot about yourself. I learned a lot about you watching you and how that trial went. I learned a lot about the science and the case. And you're right, never ever 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 forget the details of those cases.
Yeah, I remember you giving your evidence and being so proud of what you were doing up there, not just in our examination in chief, but in cross, where you were just perfect. And the preparation showed, that's the thing about trial work, is everything is in the preparation. It's all in the prep. You know, you can have the best expert in the world, but if you and the expert aren't in sync, if you haven't talked about your case, if you haven't talked about how the evidence is going to come out, if you haven't fully locked that person into the possible cross-examination tactics and questions and avenues where you can get lost, then things can go very, very, very sideways very quickly. And it's very difficult, as I'm sure you know, to fix that. In the middle, I mean, you have the opportunity to re-examine any witness and try to rehabilitate their evidence, but
sure,
damage can be fatal there.
Yeah. And I would say I haven't been to trial a lot. I've been 5 or 6 or 7 times. I don't know, but the preparation that I received before that case was the best preparation I ever had, because it's everything from literally 5 minutes on the courtroom steps to a phone call the morning of, you know, I've had all different levels of preparation. And although, you know, I hated the seventh circle of hell while I was in the middle of it, I was so grateful after the fact. I was like, wow, that really did set me up for what was to come. And I'm glad that was a successful trial for you. And I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah.
Really
well, grateful. You know what? I've now taken to telling my experts in advance, you were going to hate me until we get this decision back. And then you're going to love me. Then I'm going to be your best friend. Right? Because if everything goes well, you are going to do really well, and you're going to hold your own, and your opinion is going to come through loud and clear, and it's going to feel good. And sure enough, you know, the second or third prep meeting that I have with my witness is always me being a bit of a jerk, and sometimes like tearing a strip off them, you know, and they're not used to being spoken to that way. I mean, they're doctors, surgeons, and, you know, experts in their field, leading practitioners or nurses who are, you know, they don't want to hear from me. Like, why are you telling me how to interpret this fetal heart rate tracing? Right. But afterwards, I almost universally get either a phone call or an email saying, man, I hated you. You're right. I totally hated you. But man, did you ever do a good job preparing me? And thank you for it. I don't know that I could have done, you know, as good a job without all of the pain. Sometimes you got to get there, right? It's it's a process. It's a long process, but it's ultimately rewarding if it works well.
Yeah, for sure. It's the old tough love version of lawyering.
Yeah.
So listen, you and I could talk for, you know, probably ever if we had nothing else to do for the day. But I think it's time that we wrap up this version of the podcast with just one more question that I ask everybody at the end, because I'd like to come back for a few minutes and talk a little bit more. I mean, we have, to be fair, talked a lot about your personal life in this podcast. We've gotten down with it, but there's some other stuff I'd like to know about you, about, you know, what you're up to these days and what your plans are for the future. Yeah. So let me just ask you this last question, which I ask everybody. And because podcast listeners include lawyers and doctors and nurses and the general public, I'd like you to answer for each one of those audiences this question. In your view, what is the most important thing? And let's start with doctors and nurses. The most important thing that doctors and nurses need to know about medical malpractice.
That it's not a personal affront. That it's not personal. It's not personal, even though your name is on a lawsuit. That it is about fairness, justice, and a fair society, one in which, you know, victims are compensated and made whole, and you'll get over it. You will get over this. You will walk away from this case, win, lose, or draw, and your life will likely not look much different. But this is my client's, this family's only shot at getting compensation that often has to carry them a very, very long time, and sometimes for the long haul. You know, you and I do a lot of these obstetrical malpractice cases, and we see the kinds of challenges that families who are caring for babies with cerebral palsy or any kind of encephalopathy have in their marriage, in their life. And so the case is tremendously important to them. It's personal to them. But to the healthcare providers, I would just say, just swallow your pride once in a while. If you've made a mistake, face up to that. Acknowledge the things that you need to acknowledge. It's not an indictment. We all make mistakes. I do it too. We're not perfect human beings. We're flawed. We're going to make mistakes. But when you make a mistake, acknowledge it. And don't dig in your heels. And don't say things that don't make sense. Don't lie on the stand. Don't lie at your examination for discovery.
Right.
And just understand that this is about something beyond your ego or my ego or anyone else. It's just about these people who are trying to put together the pieces of a life that has been interrupted and sometimes ended.
I think maybe that's the best answer I've ever heard to that question.
Nailed it.
Well said. That's what we're after. Okay, I could let you off the hook there, but I'd love to hear what you have to say since you were so good on that one. What is the most important thing that you'd like other lawyers to know about medical malpractice?
It's really hard. You shouldn't do it. Leave it to the professionals. Mm-hmm. It's not, and I say that in jest in part, but it is. I do see sort of a move now towards having more lawyers in this area, people who are advertising at least as doing this work. I think you got to be really, really careful about the cases that you take on. Some of these cases are really, really complex. In fact, most medical malpractice cases, I don't know any really straightforward ones. They are all quite complicated. I've spent 20 plus years doing this work. I'm still learning. I'm interested in the medicine. That's what keeps me engaged in this. Not only, you know, apart from, you know, working with people who I want to help, it is an intellectually challenging and stimulating field. One that I consider myself lucky to be working in, but it's not something that you can dip your feet into. It's not the kind of law that you can practice while you're doing, you know, your other estate law or commercial litigation. It's more challenging than that. you really need to understand the complexities of this, particularly on the plaintiff side. The defense firms are well-trained. Their lawyers are well-trained. They're usually brought up and trained from when they're pups, right up until the point where they're doing trials. And I came through one of those firms myself. So I was very well trained there about, how to defend doctors, which helped, obviously has helped in my analysis of cases now as a plaintiff's lawyer. But that would be my advice. Don't take these cases on because you think that they're big or they're likely to pay out. They might be big, but they're, the chances of paying out are only as good as the arguments that you can make and the experts that you can bring to bear. The CMPA and HEROC, they're not here to just settle cases for the sake of settling it. They're sophisticated. They're very, very good lawyers. And so you need to know what you're doing in these cases. You can't fool around. And you can do real harm by not doing, a good job. I mean, if you take a case to an examination for discovery and you don't ask the right questions, you may have ruined any possibility of getting the admissions that you need to secure a trial victory or a settlement. And, some clients come to me after they've been with another firm and the discoveries have been done, and you take a look at the discoveries and you think, oh my goodness, no wonder they're not going to settle with you. Now you're going and you're flying in blind at a trial. You don't know what's going to come at you, and you haven't been able to secure those admissions. So,
yeah, that's also really good advice. Yeah. And I even see it, as we find experts for lots of lawyers across the country, and every once in a while we'll get a phone call from someone like that who just found a case that they think might make some money, and they're green as grass and they don't have any co-counsel. And we fear for the plaintiff. We fear for the experts that we find for them. Yeah. And you're just like, you shouldn't be doing this. And try to encourage, it's a tough conversation to have, but like, to gently but firmly say, you need some help and I'm going to point you in the right direction, because you shouldn't be doing this on your own if you don't have the basics.
Yeah, for sure.
So last question here, answer this question for the general public. What do they need to know, the most important thing the general public needs to know about medical malpractice?
It's more common than you think. It's more common than you think. I mean, in 2004, they came out with, Canadian Medical Journal came out with the adverse event study showing that there are upwards of 24,000 deaths annually in our hospitals from preventable adverse events. These are events not related to underlying illness. They are events directly flowing from healthcare. Some of these, 36%, which I think is an underestimation, is highly preventable, as the study's authors deemed it to be. And I think you need to question more. We have, all of us, a tendency to trust our doctors and to believe that we're getting the best care, and that when things go wrong, it may be somebody else's fault, but not your doctor's fault, or it might be your fault because you weren't doing something, or that just happens. Sometimes that is the case. Sometimes it's unavoidable. Things happen in healthcare. There's no guarantee of a good outcome. But understand your health, understand what's being provided to you. And if you don't know, then call. There are good lawyers out there who can give you advice. Most of my clients who come to call, I tell them they probably don't have a case. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your money. But at least they have that answer, as opposed to wondering. And so that's what I would say. I would say, question everything. You have the right to question. And if anyone tells you that you don't have the right to question, question why they're telling you that too. It's your health, it's your life, and treat that with the respect that it deserves. And if you're not getting the right answers, then find someone who can give those to you. Find a good lawyer in your neighborhood, in your city, or in your province, who can answer questions. And if they're caring and they're thoughtful and they know what they're doing, they will take the time to talk to you and tell you whether or not there is merit to your question or to your concern, or whether there isn't.
Also a good answer. And for everybody listening, Alex is now a newly redefined, kinder, gentler, more compassionate and very, very experienced and successful malpractice lawyer. So you can find him and give him a call. And he's awesome. And he's the plug. And he's fun and he's funny and he's a lovely man. So we'll just call this part of it done, Alex. I just want to say thank you so much for the incredible sharing, the generous sharing of your time and your knowledge and your personal insights, and for being as vulnerable as you were and talking to us about what you did. It means a lot to me that you'd feel safe in this setting to talk about some of those things. And I know it's been a sometimes painful journey, but I'm also so hopeful and inspired by your journey back, and that you're back in the saddle again and doing really well. I've enjoyed every single second of talking to you, like I always have. If you haven't already listened to it, what?
Ditto.
Ditto? Yeah, ditto. There you go. If you haven't already listened to it, don't miss the shorter podcast where Alex is going to talk about what he does when he's not busy being a lawyer. I'm going to ask him what he was like as a child. I wish I had his mom on the show to answer that question. What advice he might give his younger self, and what gets him up and out of bed every morning. So, Alex, thank you once again. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Chris.